This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We're talking about, you know, a very important issue. Folks, you just cannot make this stuff up. You know, President Trump, when he talked about ICE enforcement, immigration enforcement, he talked about the dangers, and the stories that are revealing themselves are just very telling. In fact, there was a roundup in New Jersey. There were nationals of Anguilla, Bangladesh, Cameroon, Colombia, Cuba, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, Egypt, El Salvador, Ghana, Guatemala, Guinea, Guyana, Haiti, Honduras, Jamaica, Korea, Macedonia, Mexico, Nicaragua, Pakistan, Philippines, Peru, Poland, Spain, St. Lucia, Trinidad, and Venezuela that were arrested. And everybody wants to say that this is all about anything that's going on is about just the Central American countries and the Mexican border. It's not true. It's much bigger than that. And in fact, this roundup also netted folks that have been convicted for aggravated assault, child endangerment, criminal sexual contact, kidnapping, homicide, drug offenses, and other crimes. And there were over 91 foreign nationals arrested. And here to talk to us about this happenstance and the challenges that ICE faces across the country is Jessica Vaughn, director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thanks so much. Glad to be with you.
Jessica, I make the observation in the opening statement simply to make the point that everybody thinks it's only about what's going on in the border, and this challenge and these issues are so much broader than that. What say you?
That's exactly right. Illegal immigration is a problem from countries all over the world, and about 40% of the illegal population living in the United States has come in on legal visas and overstayed them. And the big problem is that enforcement in the interior of the country has been ignored, or at least was ignored for many years prior to the Trump administration making it a priority. But I think it's important for people to understand also that the highest priority for enforcement always has been that small fraction of the illegal population that is committing other crimes, who come to ICE's attention because they've done something else that gets them arrested by state and local law enforcement agencies. And they, you know, that's why they're a priority. They want to use their resources on the people who are creating the most problems in the communities where they're living. That's not to say that they don't sometimes arrest others, or that, you know, worksite enforcement is not also legitimate, but this is the main priority for ICE. And they have to do many more of these operations now in the community because there are so many jurisdictions that have these misguided sanctuary policies that prevent ICE from making their arrests of their priority targets in the jails, where it's safe for the ICE officers and safe for the community. Now, because of sanctuary policies that release these individuals, they've got to go, ICE has to go out and get them.
Yeah, you know, and I've had a number of shows on this issue, and some people say and think that I've had too many. But the fact of the matter is that as a former law enforcement officer and a sheriff, I am very much concerned about and as you pointed out, and I think this is a good distinction, is that it's a small faction of the number of illegals that are in this country that are having a huge impact in the quality of life in our communities across this country, that are wreaking havoc because they are impact criminals. They are sucking the life out of communities across this country. And why we would want to protect those folks, I have no idea.
Right. And the people who are most harmed by sanctuary policies or other non-enforcement policies that end up protecting these criminal aliens are other immigrants, because these criminal aliens often, most often, prey on their own communities where they're living. Especially, you know, one of the people arrested in this operation in New Jersey was an MS-13 member who trafficked in firearms and narcotics. He's not coming to my neighborhood. He's terrorizing people in his neighborhood where he can, you know, his fellow gang members extort people, they sexually assault people, they make life miserable in immigrant communities. And so enforcement protects everybody.
They're engaged in the same conduct they were engaged in from their origin country. They move into these communities that are the folks from other origin country that they can just, you know, wreak havoc on and take advantage of. Not unlike what they did back home.
That's right. And some of these problems are too big for local law enforcement agencies to deal with on their own. And when you have members of the community who are in the country illegally, they're very vulnerable to enforcement by ICE. And that's why it's really important to have partnerships and open lines of communication between local police, sheriffs, and immigration authorities, so they can work together to remove these people from the streets. Because especially you find with gang members, MS-13 is truly a transnational gang that operates across borders, and you want ICE to come in and help deal with them. You know, no local police department should have to try to cope with that on their own.
There were a series of articles done by a reporter, I think his name was Mike Miller, with the Washington Post, as I recall, and he talked about a middle school on the East Coast that had been completely taken over by the MS-13. And in fact, the teachers, the administrators, and everyone else were completely in fear of this gang. And it, like you said, it was a small number of folks, but they just completely wreaked havoc. And the name of the school is the William Wharton Middle School in Riverdale, Maryland. And it's gotten to the point where people are just throwing up their arms. They don't even know what to do anymore. They can't protect their kids.
That is very, very sad that it's gotten to that point, that it's almost like a no-go zone. And MS-13 is a uniquely brutal gang. I mean, they have their power and intimidation abilities through violence, because they're completely bloodthirsty and brutal. And they would, you know, slit somebody's throat at the drop of a hat just to prove how bad they are. And their presence in this country has grown very recently because since 2012 there's been this influx of unaccompanied minors and families with kids from Central America. The gang understood that the lenient policies would result in teenagers being released when they arrived at the border illegally. And so they specifically recruited teens from El Salvador and Honduras, especially, to grow the ranks of the gangs here in the United States. And on top of it, all of these other families also coming in here who were getting released to apply for asylum, their kids are in these same schools, and they're very vulnerable to recruitment by MS-13 or sometimes 18th Street and other gangs, and it is causing this kind of Wild West atmosphere in these schools. The problem is, you know, some of these school authorities don't want to admit that they have bad gang problems. They don't want to work with police because, you know, they think that, you know, sends a wrong signal of some kind. But the parents are very upset about it, and it's got to be addressed, and it's going to take immigration enforcement and other law enforcement action to get these thugs out of the schools.
Jessica, you know, this change in, they say it's a change in policy as it relates to this asylum issue, and it seems as though they're trying to address loopholes. There's been an 872% increase in persons seeking asylum since 2009. So where are we? For our listening audience, where exactly are we? And what are, I understand there are five criteria that are looked at in trying to determine whether or not you're eligible for asylum in this country.
That's right. In the early 2000s, there were something like 5,000 people a year who would show up at the border seeking asylum. Now it's more than 90,000, probably this year approaching 100,000 or more. So the reason it's gone up so much is because of a change that was originally made under the Obama administration that imposed a catch and release policy that, you know, overturned decades of policy that said, you know, we're going to hold you in custody until your case is decided. That was gone by the wayside, so hence this surge from Central America. And also under the Obama administration in 2014, there was a decision by the immigration courts that found that women who experienced domestic violence or people who were who had witnessed crimes and lived in crime-ridden areas in Central America could potentially get asylum here, and you know that also opened up the opportunity for people to come here and start making claims, just, you know, saying that they were fleeing violence or fleeing their husband. They had nowhere to go, so they had to leave their home countries and that the government wouldn't protect them. What the Attorney General has done is to use his authority to instruct immigration judges on how to interpret the law and say that, look, we're going to go back to what the law actually says that was passed in 1980 that says if you want refuge here, you have to show that you've been persecuted based on your race, religion, citizenship, or membership in a particular social group, and that your government is enabling this persecution. That it's not enough to say simply that you live in a crime-ridden area or that your husband beats you. Sad as those situations are, that's not a basis for political asylum. And so this is really going back to what the law intended rather than its current kind of, you know, stretched beyond belief form that we see now, and just to impose some what the Attorney General calls legal discipline on this process. It's that we all sympathize and understand that there are countries that struggle to, you know, to achieve civil society and that people live in hardship, but the immigration laws of the United States are not a remedy for that, and you know, we can't solve those problems by letting everyone move here. And they have other options, too. Even if they are genuinely persecuted, they can apply in safe third countries like Mexico or Costa Rica or Panama. You know, it should not be, you know, a highway of people coming to the United States thinking that they can relocate here on the basis of these admittedly sad situations, but, you know, which are not really persecution.
You know, historically, it's always been about government persecution or government action in many cases. And it seems as though now the detractors to this policy change are defending kind of the defensive use of asylum, especially while being deported. If they're in deportation proceedings, all of a sudden they seek asylum. And it's now, you know, the code word is government inaction. So, you know, Central American countries, they said the government's not doing anything. They're not. Well, we could make those same observations about this country. I mean, where are our domestic abuse victims? Where do they seek asylum if you're a U.S. citizen? And I mean, that's just a question. And I don't mean I don't mean to make light of it. But the fact of the matter is that there are recent reports about homicides in this country and about how many of them go unsolved. And all of these other issues that we have, where do our own citizens seek asylum when they're being persecuted against by their former loved one or otherwise?
Well, that's a really good point, and it underlines that, you know, I think we all feel sorry for and, you know, would love to be able to help people who experience violence and are victimized in that way in other countries, but we need to have the same sympathy for people who are in that situation here in the United States and help our communities deal with those problems here. It just is not a solution to say, you know, that people can just sort of pick up and move wherever they want. And I think we should be helping the governments of Central America if they want our help. deal with these problems. In the long run, that's best for everybody. And that should be the appropriate policy response for us to problems in other countries like America. If you want our help, we'll help you with, you know, however we can. But, we can't bring everyone here.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your insight. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
All righty, Jessica Vaughn with the Center for Immigration Studies.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.